Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
I'd like to say a few words about ritual today, the value of ritual as I see it. Ritual is something that that divides good people. Some love it and some don't. And almost everybody has something they'd rather not do. Beth here likes to call Gyodo, Gyo don't. Gyo, don't you do that. And I guess, as reflecting on it, I have to admit that I haven't had a big problem with ritual, kind of in general, for one reason or another. I didn't grow up Catholic or anything. Or maybe that's why it's okay. But it's... It's not something that I'm anathema to. Although, various things when I entered the monastery I didn't like. They were hard for me at first, like the speed of the chanting, which was just kind of insanely fast in the Sino-Japanese for 40 minutes. Although once I got the drum, me and Harry Buzz Buzzy, and we were going back and forth, and we'd see who could. I mean, literally, it's about as fast as you could physically keep that drum going. It was kind of it got to be exciting. but then some of the length of the ceremonies. Oh my gosh, us kneeling in seiza the whole time, and. Sometimes the teacher-centricness of the ceremonies annoyed me. Some of those things I've made some adjustments to here. But, you and I both know, so there are times, and it's hurtful to me. I mean, it pains me to see people, when people come and they don't come back. Maybe. Sometimes because the ritual just is too strange. The bowing to a Buddha statue or the chanting or what have you. And that gives me kind of a heavy heart that people who could be benefiting, I think, from this practice could find some real benefit, just don't. So it makes me think sometimes or ask myself, do we need to do this one thing? Or this or these many things? And the short answer for me is yes. I believe that the form and the ritual of Zen can and should appropriately change over time, slowly. But that form and ritual add too much to the mix to be abandoned or to be cut back without a lot of care. That they really are integral to this Zen practice and the Zen life in some way. So I'm careful. However, like I say, if you don't dig the ritual so much, I get it. And I know when some people come in, I want to try to prepare people, and I think that's one of the reasons I should give more talks like this. I do give talks about the ritual, about the different rituals. I try to talk about those different things, but I don't talk about a ritual per se. I think this is the first time I've ever done it. But to try to prepare people ahead of time for, a different experience, that they're going to have a different experience. And I know when I was at Mount Baldy Zen Center, sometimes floating through my head would be that 1980s song, turn in Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I think so. But in the main, I felt it pretty easy to be respectful and curious about the form. I think this form, and in general, form and ritual tend to cut against our cultural grain here in America, in the West, and in America maybe in particular. This is a Vipassana teacher who I talk to once every 6 weeks or so, an old friend. And he sent me a paper. He's kind of struggling with how to get this balance right himself. And he sent me a paper just recently, within the last month, by an academic called Richard Payne at Berkeley. And the title of it is Sources of Buddhist Modernist Opposition to Ritual. It's right up my alley. And he argues that we in the West, early on, when Buddhism came in with Olcott and the Theosophical Society, and you know that was the Buddhism that was introduced to Thoreau and to Emerson, that they saw Buddhism as eschewing ritual. That's the way they presented it.
Eschewing.
If by that I mean giving the boot. The ritual was really kind of a concession to magical thinking for the common folk. And then you fast forward to the 20th century, and D.T. Suzuki, you know, he had to find a way in to Western culture, and he really didn't talk about the ritual hardly at all. He talked about the philosophy, and he talked about koans, but he minimized the ritual. He was an academic, of course, though he did practice. But I think he and R.H. Blythe and Alan Watts, maybe too, you know, they wanted to portray Zen as something compatible with the modern world and modern sensibilities. So they played that part down. And it made sense. I mean, it makes sense to, you know, we have to find a way to fit in with this culture here, which is, according to this Sources of Buddhist Modernist Opposition to Ritual, one of those things is Protestant culture. You know, starting with Luther and Calvin, those guys broke from the ritual in the Catholic tradition, and they made intellect primary. It was really about the belief; it wasn't about the ritual action that gave you salvation. And I'm struck even now when I talk to minister friends about their training, you know, it's academic. I mean, it's 90 whatever percent academic and intellectual. And that fits into this, what's called an intellectualist view that reasoned thought needs to precede action. As many of you know, I'm a big fan of the Enlightenment, of our 18th century Enlightenment. And all of that, all the things that it gave us, all the things that it ushered in. But I also think that the revolution of reason can go too far. That if it becomes a dogma in and of itself, it's the same with the rights of the individual, which also I'm a big fan of. But if that's taken as dogma, it can eclipse the need for community, I think, and the power of what the Korean Buddhists call together action. Ritual action does a few things for us. It gets us out of our heads. for one thing. Ritual is with, we do ritual with our bodies, and we do it without talking about it. It's a bodily practice. So, you know, whether it's bowing or serving tea or chanting or the choreography of the service positions that we do, they're a way to use our bodies without thinking. And that keeps us remembering our body as we do this practice. Not just sitting still, but also moving. And it keeps us tied to this present moment in a way. It also gives us a chance to practice not thinking while moving, something that has been precious for me over the years. One of these days I'd like to give us a chance to do this. We don't do it at retreats. It's just too complicated. But serving each other, serving food. So we have these servers who serve everybody. You know, three servers, two servers who serve everybody food. You don't serve yourself. And I tell you, I love that job. I think, Lydia, you like that one too, didn't you? It's such a dance to do that job and to just move gracefully as you can from person to person, you know, quickly without thinking. You just concentrate on what that person, you know. You remember that ability, yeah. And it really is a kind of dance, the ritual in general. If you think of it that way, that might help. I don't know. There's this story of a Westerner telling a Shinto priest, you know, I see your rituals, but I don't get your theology. I don't get your ideology. And he says, we don't have an ideology. We don't have a theology. We dance. And, you know, I think in Zen we have a philosophy. We have a kind of theology, if you want to call it that. But you can't get there without dancing. And you can't talk your way there in this practice. You have to feel your way there. You have to dance your way there. Isadora Duncan, isn't that her name? Mm-hmm. I actually didn't go back and make sure that was her name. She's got this quote, you know, famous dancer. Mm-hmm. If I could say it, I wouldn't have to dance it. So that might help. And we do this practice, this ritual practice over and over. That's one of the things that makes it a kind of ritual. And I think that these forms become a kind of signal to our unconscious. It's time to settle. Okay, tea's coming. We can do this without thinking. It's the whole form out here. You walk in, you smell the incense. Okay, time to settle. All of those forms. Do that. We can do this without thinking. It's kind of almost Pavlovian that way. And after, do you remember Kerwin and Emily, a young couple, millennials? Mm-hmm. They did the sesshin at Bodhi. They went totally cold. They did it totally cold turkey. I mean, they hadn't done anything before. They hadn't even stepped in a Zendo. They just drove by. They rode their bikes by here and they saw Zen Center. And they looked us up online and said, oh, they're doing it down there. They happened to be traveling down there, so they just walked right on. And afterwards, I thought, oh my gosh, how did they do? And of course, they did fantastic. And Kerwin said what really struck him was the rhythm of everything. There was so much rhythm in the retreat, the rhythm of chanting, the rhythm of walking, the rhythm of your breath, the rhythm of the han. There was so much beat to it. And I think ritual gets us in touch with rhythm, which is not about ourselves, not about our own story. It's just joining this other rhythm. Which, again, I think actually all of those help us find the rhythm of our breath, which is so helpful in this practice. And that rhythm also, of course, helps us dance with our body and let go into it. Letting go into the rhythm, the soothing rhythm of our breath, letting go into the container that is built by this rhythm, by the ritual action. And that's particularly true during a retreat. There was a woman, Catherine, at Mount Baldy Zen Center, who came from a, you know, much softer and looser yoga tradition. And to my surprise, after her first session, she said, "I just loved the form." Mm-hmm. Like, because, she said, it gave me a container that I could lose myself into. She felt held by it. And I think that ritual does that. It creates a container that we can safely give ourselves up into. And to do this practice is difficult, to really stop thinking momentarily, to give ourselves up, our regular everyday thinking self. It's not easy. And the form gives us something to kind of hold us while we do that. And this space, which we keep clean and quiet and consistent with a similar ritual action, becomes a ritual space, one that we can enter and drop into, drop our everyday self, all of our regular rhythms, and enter into new rhythms that are pointed in a different direction. Try on another way of being, one that is made for transformation. So we come into a ritual space, transform, and then leave again. It's important to keep that ritual space, I think. It's very helpful. Of course, we also do it all together. We do these rituals all together. And that tightens, I think, the bonds of our community. It is a community action that we, ritual action is community action, and together action, as the Koreans say. It was Andreas at this last session in Norway, who came from the Vipassana tradition, and was, he said the first couple of days, he just thought, "Oh, what have I gotten myself into? You know, it's just all of this walking in step, military, blah, 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 blah." He bucked up against it, he said. But then after a while, after a few days, he could feel the energy that all of that together action gave him. It was like, and he felt we were all like doing this together in a way that he didn't, in certain other contexts. I think also one thing I want to say about the form is that, and I feel this very, very much during a retreat, some of these forms really come alive during especially a longer retreat. But whether it's a retreat or here, after doing it for a while, it becomes your form. And that's kind of a switch. At first, it's something that's just sort of laid on you or that you have to fit into. But after a while, it really can become your form. And that kind of almost emotional feeling, that switch from when we start a five-day retreat and everybody's coming from their own rhythms, oh my gosh, and tired and upset. And then little by little we come together and this becomes our little life. And we're in sync and we've learned the dance, we've put on the clothes of this form. Then it's something that we can rely on and something that we can use. And that's the word that comes to mind for me, that we can use this form if we really take it on. That we can use it to further the practice, to help each other. It becomes our rhythm, our life, part of us in a way. And that's a strong moment in a sesshin when that happens. And it doesn't, it's not that, it doesn't just give us energy, that moment, or, you know, the together action. It also gives us a sense of camaraderie, you know, of bodily sense of camaraderie, which is subtle, but can be very strong. You know, I was a fan of this book, The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, and just part of that, he talks about this sociologist who started in the army and went into basic training, and he said the thing that he learned most from basic training was marching a step. It was amazing for him, just the feeling of it, and it, he said it enlarged him in some way, got him out of his own self. And of course I think about that with Kinhin, because there are times when I just want to drop it here, because it's hard to keep in step, you know, in this kind of uneven ground. Whereas during a sesshin, I just love it, you know, with the chuk, 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 we all get together. Said it enlarged him in a way, it changed his life. And yeah, the sense of community is one of the most important parts of Zen practice, I think. And it's shared ritual helps build that in ways that are subtle. And lastly, it connects us, these rituals, of course, some of them more than others, to past rhythms. That many of them have some reason, some meaning. And the meaning with the ritual is not on the surface, because we're not, it's not a creed, it's not something we're talking about. And I like that about ritual meanings. And when I went to Mount Baldy Zen Center, nobody explained nothing to me about what the meaning of these things were. So they opened up slowly, these meanings, to me. I'd hear a little bit here, a little here, a little bit there, and I'd kind of make it up myself too. Oh, that's what that means to me. So the meaning can be complex, I think. And you know, like the Han, that's a call to serious practice, because we know what traditionally is written on it. But it also involves sound and the bodily feeling of wood against wood, and the emotion, you know, that you get from the person playing it, and the look of the thing there, you know, has associations for me. And I know that, you know, Elaine Hanawell made it, and that Jim made the frame for it. All of this kind of enters into the meaning of the Han for me. We're adapting the forms and the rituals in the West, of course. We're doing the best we can to figure out what works in this culture. And as we change it, as we do it, I think it's important for us to really get to know the form, so that we don't just toss out the Buddha with the bathwater when we make little adjustments, to really understand it, to get a feeling for it. There's a koan that I remembered just now that's, I think, relevant, and maybe I'll finish here. That's from the Mumin Khan. It goes, "This world is wide and vast. Why, when you hear the bell, do you put on your kesa?" So, you know, the kesa is the big cape that we put on. Mm-hmm. We only do it during sesshin here. "This world is wide and vast. Why would you do that when you hear the bell? Why do you force yourself into that?" There's a cool one for you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.